Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungain here, which is at 3 o'clock, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your texts. And then there were three. Catherine Connolly, backed by the Social Democrats, Labour and People Before Profit. Heather Humphreys, backed by Fine Gael. And Jim Gavin, Fianna Fáil's candidate, now on the pitch. And there are a number of aspiring independents who are going around the local councils at the moment, some of them quibbling over whether or not those local councils should facilitate them going forward, asking party members, members who have already clearly given their backing to some or all of those candidates there that we've just named, to facilitate them going forward for election and allow independents into the race as well. We'll throw it out there to the listeners. What do you think yourself? Do you think that members of political parties should facilitate independents to go in to the presidential race and facilitate greater choice? Or are members of political parties well within their rights to use their place on the council to vote according to the interests of their party's candidates and improve the prospect of it being a three-way race and limited to a three-way race between those party-backed candidates that we have so far? Sinn Féin yet to declare its hand. We hear they're due to declare on in the 20s of September, and there may or may not be a candidate there as well. So those party members may be keeping their powder dry. But should all party members be looking to widen the field as broadly as possible to give the widest choice to the electorate? Or, as I say, are they well within their rights to limit the field and make sure that it's advantage their party's candidates? 51551 for your texts, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps. Now, politics, obviously, a darker side of it has been in the news. You may have been following it in the newspapers over recent days. Credible threats to Simon Harris and his family. He spoke out about it and he did an interview on Morning Ireland this morning in which he said that, you know, he doubted if a lot of people, if there was a threat to their family, would relish the prospect of going into work. But he said he had to dig deep himself and go into work anyway because of threats to the family. Now, politicians are used to getting robust criticism over the policy choices they make, over the measures they support, over what they don't do. But many would say there has to be a line drawn where it comes into personalised or violent abuse, criticising appearance, or in particular, threatening harm to their family. In fact, it's a criminal offence. It's a rare day you come into the studio with Round Hall Nutshells books, Criminal Law, 4th edition by Cecilia Nicquillon, rounding up the various sanctions that apply to criminal offences. But harassments and threats of violence are contained in that book and the list of sanctions that are available to judges when harassments and threats are made. Micheál Carrigy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
We normally talk about matters political on other programmes, but in this case, we are looking at the issue of politicians. You know, the issue of politicians getting abuse is one thing, but family members being threatened and threatened credibly to the point that it lands in court is a different issue entirely. I think in your own words, you said a line was crossed when somebody threatened your family.
That's correct. It's over 2.5 years ago I started to get those comments, threats on social media, and then that led to phone calls and messages being sent, and ultimately threats made against my own children. And I think, as you said, that was a line that was too far, a line that had been crossed, and that's where I made contact with the Gardaí at the time to investigate and identify who the culprit was. And I have to say that was dealt with very, very swiftly by the Gardaí in identifying the person who was responsible for sending those messages and indeed those threats.
And you said it had been going on for 2.5 years. I mean, the individual concerned was ultimately found guilty or pleaded guilty in 2023, but it had been going on, had it, since around 2020, 2021?
No, it was about 2.5 years ago.
Sorry, apologies. How long had the abuse been going on for before you decided to take the matter to the Gardaí?
It was in the region of 2.5 to 3 months, and it just seemed to see an increase in the comments that were being made on the various social media accounts. And as I said, then I started to get messages to my phone, and then an audio message left on the phone. And I think that was the point that I contacted the Gardaí. I felt as a line had been crossed, and I wasn't prepared to accept it. And the only way to deal with it was to, you know, contact the Gardaí and have them investigate and identify the person responsible.
And how regular would you say these contacts, these messages were?
Weekly. I would have been, as I say, getting messages specifically on social media accounts. But as I said, then I started to get messages to the phone and on audio messages, and we contacted the Gardaí straight away. And in fairness, they dealt with it very swiftly, and a person was arrested actually within a week of me contacting the Gardaí, and the messages would have stopped after that point.
And did you know who the individual was at the time when these threats were being made?
I wasn't aware at the time, but when a person was arrested, it happened to be a person from my own home county in Longford, and it would have been someone that I would have known of back over the years. I wouldn't have known them very, very well personally, but they were the person that I knew, and a person that would have known me as well.
And did they give you any indication when the threats were being made that they were in the same county as you are, that they knew anything about you or your movements or the names of your family?
Well, yeah, with the messages that were being left, I would have, you know, felt that there were, either they knew where my office was, where it was located, my house, different things that happened, and I felt it was somebody that was, as I say, within the county and knew some of my movements, so that left you know, quite difficult. But I wasn't able to identify a person myself, and I suppose it left me suspicious of people that you might have met, or maybe walking by the office, or, you know, or so. But as I say, the Gardaí dealt with it extremely swiftly, and a person was arrested within 1 week, and it was disappointing, you know, to know that it was someone in my own community that was doing this, the community I was representing to the best of my ability, and that they felt that they could do this to advance their views on certain issues. As I am a public representative, I have a constituency office, and that's where I'm prepared to meet people, discuss any issue or any differences people have with me. And so I think it's not acceptable, you know, for people to air their differences in the format that has been with the tarnished over recent weeks, attacking his house and his family. As I say, it's not acceptable. We need people to put themselves forward for public life and know that they can do their job without, you know, this happening. So I totally empathise with him and his family at this time. And as I say, it's a difficult time.
Yeah, I undoubtedly, you know, and I appreciate, you know, you don't want to get into the particulars, or particularly, you know, put your own family to the front of this. But did you make them aware of this? Were they aware of it? Or was it a family discussion you had about this? Or did you deal with this solely yourself? Were you the only one aware of these threats?
I would have dealt with it myself. I thought that was the best way to deal with it. And as I say, I put my trust in the Gardaí to, you know, to deal with the issue swiftly, you know, which they did. It would have then, when the case, and I decided to push, you know, the case, I knew that it was going to, you know, come out in the media. They would have let them know that this, you know, more likely it was going to be either on the newspapers or radio or television in relation to it, which was the case. So it was a difficult time, and particularly for my oldest son that would have been aware of it. But right. I felt it was the right thing to do, as the line had been crossed, and I wasn't prepared to sit back and you know take any more of it. I felt I had to, you know, take a stand, and hopefully then that this would deter it from happening to any other person that's involved in politics.
And had you altered your behaviour? You mentioned there that, you know, you didn't know who to trust, you were cautious of people in and around your constituency office. As you walked around, going to the constituency office, coming from it, were you a bit more vigilant, and how did it affect your life kind of day to day?
Yeah, but definitely it just left you a little bit more easy and a bit more, as I say, suspicious of people if someone walked by the office. And so I had put in extra security at my office there as well, where I have a constituency staff member working. And I suppose one thing that's come from it, you know, within the Oireachtas, the previous Cancord O'Shanna Farrell set up a commission with Noreen O'Sullivan, the former Garda Commissioner, you know, to look into participation in public life, and a significant number of recommendations were made. I suppose on the back of that, I would have fed into that with my own personal experiences. And we've seen, you know, increased funding being put in place there for people to put extra security at both their homes and indeed their constituency offices. It shouldn't have to happen, but unfortunately, we're in a situation where, as I say, there are people out there that feel that people in political life are targets, but we're there to serve our community, and we should be able to do that without any fear.
And what about the staff in the constituency office? Were they concerned about it?
Yeah, they would have been, yeah, because I made them aware, and some of the comments on the social media was, you know, referencing where my office was and where it was located. So it was a difficult time for them also, you know, feeling it was somebody going to come into the office at any time. So that's why it was important to put in the various security measures, you know, that we did. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that you have to do that, but it's important that your staff feel safe in their workplace.
And for, you know, the guards made an arrest within a week, and from then to the point of sentencing, you know, how long did that take, and how was that for you?
That was difficult. You know, it was before the courts for a number of months, and before a suspended sentence was given. So that was a difficult time, and I think maybe it could be dealt with maybe more swiftly. But it was important that there was a sentence put in place on the person that carried this out. And would hope that, you know, me taking that case would deter others from doing the same for other people in political life.
And what about, you know, as you waited for this, as it became public, were there other people giving abuse online about the fact that you were pursuing a complaint?
No, I didn't, I'll be quite honest, but I would have, you know, been talking to a number of other politicians, both at local level and national level, that would have, you know, said about, you know, abuse that they would have got. And I suppose my advice was, you know, was to go to the local Gardaí. If we don't report these issues happening, we won't be able to identify, you know, people that are carrying this out. And indeed, with my case, actually, when the Gardaí investigated, they actually found evidence where the same individual was actually carrying out abuse of Minister Mary Butler. And so, and they were able, she followed up with a case as well, and the person also got a suspended sentence in relation to her case.
Right. But in contemplating bringing the complaints to the guards, did you worry there'd be an online backlash? Did you, you know, consider that if this person was giving abuse to you, that he might be one of a number of people and that the problem may widen? Or did you decide enough was enough? What was going through your head? What different considerations were you weighing up?
I always felt that was a possibility, but as I said at the beginning, a line had been crossed, and I just made a decision that I needed to, you know, push this issue. And if I didn't, then this was only going to continue, both for me and for other people, as I say, in political life or in any public office. So that was really the decision that outweighed, and I felt it was the right decision to do at the time. I still believe it was the right decision I made. I love the job I do. I love representing my community in Longford, Westmead, and I wasn't going to let something like that deter me from doing that.
Right. And ultimately, as you say, the individual concerned got a suspended sentence. The judge took into account the guilty plea, the fact that the individual had no previous convictions, and sentencing was delayed to allow the individual concerned to engage with probation and psychiatric services. So the suspended sentence was imposed. I think it was a 5-month suspended sentence, suspended for 18 months. I mean, how did you feel when the sentence was handed down?
And I felt relief that you know, but a sentence had been given. I think that was the most important thing to me, that, you know, I took a stand on it, and that I'd followed through on it, and that the person was found guilty in a court of law, and that suspended sentence would, as I say, deter him from doing it, or others from doing it to other people in public life.
Right, and there were conditions imposed to avoid the street your constituency office is on, to avoid contact with you. There were a number of conditions imposed as part of this suspension of the sentence.
That's correct, yeah, there was a number of conditions imposed. So I was happy that that was put in place, you know, and that's ultimately, as I say, I made that decision. You know, based on, as I say, that threat to my kids, and as I say, the line had been crossed, and the person had been found guilty in a court of law of doing it, and I think that was a positive result.
And has it had any knock-on effect for you in terms of reducing the amount of abuse you get now, seeing as you are now clearly someone who's going to pursue criminal complaints if threats are directed to you? Has it improved the kind of messaging you get online, or are you still dealing with fairly toxic output online?
Well, I think all of us, unfortunately, in public life get a certain amount of toxicity online. I think that's something maybe the social media companies need to look at, what content they allow on the various platforms. And in fact, in my work as a member of the media committee, we've met a lot of social media companies. There's actually certain content that they will not take down, even they know it's factually incorrect, if it's aimed at someone that's in political life, which I don't think is unacceptable. We're citizens the same as everybody else, so we should have the same protections with regard to false allegations or false information being put up online about us. And it's something that we highlighted with those companies when they were in with us in the media committee.
Right, but you're not satisfied with that response. You feel more could be done by them?
I think so, yeah. They need to be more swifter. Like, it can be a toxic place, a lot of the online platforms, and I think they're making significant profits as companies, and I'm sure that, you know, they should have the technology there to be able to take down any falsehoods or false allegations that are being made down straight away.
Do you think it's had an effect on politics? You know, I listed out a number of people, the People Before Profit Solidarity TD. Paul Murphy has had threats made against his family. Alan Kelly, the Labour TD, talked about the same thing. There's obviously your case. The Taoiseach to Simon Harris was out today. There are, you know, I suppose, while it's not acceptable for the public representative himself in any fashion or form to be threatened, for it to tip into a family being threatened is a whole other area as well. I mean, do you think these kinds of threats have had an effect on how politicians might be prepared to interact with the public? A freezing effect maybe on clinics, you know, where they hold their clinics, how remotely they hold them, how many people they have on hand when a clinic is being held, and the possibility of holding smaller clinics?
Well, as I said earlier on in the interview, like, your office now is providing funding for security at office, so that really highlights, you know, the concerns that they have. And anecdotally, over the number of years, like, you know, I would have heard people just, you know, saying that they weren't going to put themselves forward for maybe going for elections at a local authority level or even at a higher level because of it. And you've seen in relation to the presidential election where Tony Houlihan made the decision to not, you know, put his name forward for election. So, like, as I say, we need to take a strong stance on that, and that's what I fully empathise with the Taoiseach in the comments that he's made in relation to this.
And just looking at sort of the legal position of it, threats, the threat to kill or cause serious harm, punishment on conviction, the maximum term of imprisonment in the lower courts is 12 months of a fine or 2,500, or in a higher court, 10 years and an unlimited fine. I mean, how do you react to that? All right, OK, we seem to have lost the line there. We're going to take a short break. We're back in a minute. Threats to public representatives, or more particularly to members of public representatives' families, is what we were looking at earlier. Bridget Dermody, good afternoon to you.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. You heard me all Carrigie earlier. You no doubt heard what Taoiseach Simon Harris was talking about, threats of a vile nature being made against his family, specific violent threats against them. Clearly, you know, yeah. politicians are left morning, yeah. are left shaken by this. But you yeah. you heard what Micheál Carrigy was saying in terms of, you know, how these threats are dealt with. What are your own thoughts on it?
Is that the last speaker now? Because that's me. Yeah, that's the only one I heard.
That's yeah. the gentleman we heard just before the break. There, yeah.
My thoughts on it. I think that there should be serious jail sentences. This is a serious crime. It's a crime against the people of Ireland. The worry is that if this is allowed to happen, people will not go forward in politics. They won't go forward for election. People who represent certain points of view. And we will end up with mainly right-wing points of view, because the people that are being threatened are all centre or left. That's my understanding.
Some of the people certainly who've come forward about it, but you know, and who are elected public representatives, would come from centre or the left, yeah.
Yeah. And I'd say there are a lot of people who haven't come forward, but who are concerned. The subject has been going on for quite a long time now, hasn't it? And local politicians are saying that they're being threatened. Simon Harris's case is appalling. It's absolutely appalling. And he's right. We have to do something about it. The sentences have to be far more severe. I believe in the people's right to protest and right to speak their mind. But Irish people have huge access to their politicians.
And you think this affects that, do you?
Sorry?
You think this is in danger of affecting people's access to their politicians?
Oh, yes, very much so. We're very politically aware in Ireland. We know our politicians. And we have good politicians. And we vote. I mean, it concerns me that the vote is going down. And if this continues, the vote is going to go down even more.
And is that access to politicians on a very local level important to you?
It is. It absolutely is. We're very lucky to have it.
What difference does it make to you?
Sorry, you're breaking up.
Yeah, what difference does it make to you that the knowledge that you could go to a politician's constituency clinic and talk to them directly, politicians of any party and none, and make your views known to them about matter of policy or a particular concern you may have? How important is that to you, whether you do it or not, to know that you can do it?
Yes, it's very important. I don't know how else I can say
all right.
it.
No,
it's fundamental to our politics. And you would be very worried.
You think yeah. custodial sentences should be imposed for people who engage in this sort
yeah,
of abuse?
Yeah, long custodial sentences. I wouldn't hold back at all. This is how we run our country, and this is what is being attacked.
All right. Well,
and we will find that we go to the polls and we elect our representatives, and we want to be able to elect people that can do the job. And you'd wonder, more and more people who can do the job and who are talented and who are interested and are capable would be less and less inclined to go forward. And I don't know what we'd be left with.
Well, we certainly did, and there was a number of people who didn't put themselves forward at the last general election because of the impact they said it had on them and their family. Micheál Carrigy, you're back. Your line dropped out there for a moment. I just wanted to get your reaction to the sentences that are available. The maximum term imprisonment in a lower court is 12 months or a fine of €2,500, or conviction in a higher court, the maximum term is 10 years or an unlimited fine. Do you think the scope of the legislation at the moment is wide enough? Are you happy with, you know, those sanctions being in the books, or do you think that could be tightened up?
Well, I think there's sufficient legislation there, and look, it's not my role to tell the judiciary how to do their job, but I would just ask, you know, that they would look at the issues that we're discussing now, and that, you know, we look at them. I think strongly, you've mentioned there earlier about the full access you have to your our politicians, and I think that's something that we don't have in a lot of other democracies, and we want to see that continuing. So, as I say, the legislation is just there, just we just need to implement it.
All right. Shane O'Diver, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Colm. How are you?
You are a doctor of history, and this is a specific area you have looked at since the dawn of the state, threats to politicians.
Sure. Well, security is an area I've examined quite extensively, no doubt, and particularly in the political context. Yes, absolutely. And since the dawn of the state, Colm, as you just outlined there, yes, politicians have faced both threats and actual actions that have resulted in either injury or worse in some cases. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, people would be aware that, you know, politicians during the Civil War were assassinated, but maybe less mm-hmm. aware of how the family members of politicians mm-hmm. were affected.
True. So, as you say, many of your listeners, I think, will be aware of the for example, the murder of Sean Hales, a member of the governing pro-treaty Sinn Féin party, in December 1922. When he was killed, that prompted that infamous reaction from the then government, in which they executed four members of the anti-treaty IRA in reprisal. And so that's a rather famous incident, of course. And later on, you had, of course, the murder of Kevin O'Higgins in 1927, another famous incident that is quite well known in the popular mind. But in terms of family members, sometimes it's less well remembered now, I think, in popular history. So two examples, arguably, from the Civil War period specifically was, again, another pro-treaty Sinn Féin TD, a man called Sean McGarry. His family home was attacked in, I think it was early January of 1923. And the home was subject to an arson attack, and his seven-year-old son, Emmett McGarry, died in that particular attack. Sean McGarry himself, the TD, he survived, but his son died. And then similarly, the man I just mentioned a few moments ago, Kevin O'Higgins, he wasn't murdered until 1927, so he did survive the Civil War itself, if you will, but his father died during an attack on the family home as well during the Civil War. So yes, family members, even as far back as the Civil War, were subject to potential threat in the political context here.
And do we know if that was a direct and deliberate attack in order to intimidate Kevin O'Higgins?
Yes, it was a deliberate attack in order to intimidate or carry out a form of reprisal on O'Higgins, yes. Now, it's not necessarily the case that the attackers wanted to kill his father or kill anyone, actually, but the attack on the house was deliberate, no doubt. It was a targeted attack on the house. It's open to question whether or not the desire was to actually murder a family member on that occasion. Arguably, it wasn't. And indeed, in the case of Sean McGarry's son, again, I'm not going to claim that the attackers who firebombed the house or attacked the house wanted to kill a child. I'm not stating that either, merely that the family members were victims as a consequence of the political motivation of those who engaged in the attack, and the reason they engaged in the attack was because of the politics of a member of the victim's family.
All right.
In those cases.
And we should, in more recent times, of the list of politicians whose families or family homes were threatened, we did have a situation, obviously, where the Sinn Féin TD, Martin Kenny, had a car driven into the wall of his family home as well. So what we do know is that, and we're not saying this could have happened in any of the cases I've just outlined, the nature of the threats there. We can only deal mm-hmm. with the facts as they're established. But there have been instances in Irish history where the strength of feeling built up to a point where people certainly, whether they meant to harm or not the politician or his family, they didn't take due care with mm-hmm. the violence they perpetrated against the family home, and people died.
Absolutely. And I mean, so during the potential threats to politicians and their families did quieten down somewhat in the months you got past the, you could call it the blue shirt period of the mid-1930s. And politicians and, as a consequence, in their families did enjoy relative safety, is the term I'd use. Well, actually quite significant safety in terms of how they could conduct their personal and daily lives during the 40s, 50s and into the 60s. But once we got to the Troubles period, Colm, the potential for threat to politicians and the collateral damage that could create in terms of the impact on their families did increase quite significantly. And we had, for example, I mean, most most people, again, many of your listeners of a certain vintage, somewhat similar to myself, or even an even more delightful vintage perhaps, would be aware of the threats towards Desmond O'Malley, for example, during the early 1970s. He was Minister for Justice at that time. And direct threats were made to his life, which had an impact, obviously, not just on him as a person and as a politician, but it impacted his family life as well. Members of his family had to have security details as well, effectively, and some of his children had to be escorted to and from school by members of An Garda Síochána because of the nature of the militant, or in some cases, you could even argue, ultra-nationalist threat that O'Malley faced during that time.
Right, you're talking about the late 60s, early 70s there, are you?
That's correct. As I said, the mid-20th century period was a relatively safe one for politicians and their families, by and large, I think it's fair to say.
Right, but the subsequent government to that, the Fine Gael Labour government, were mm-hmm. made aware of another specific threat in which their families wouldn't be mm-hmm. collateral damage, but in fact may be direct targets. What do we know about that?
That is correct, Colm, you're correct, yeah. So it was in the latter part of 1973 and into 1974, the then Fine Gael Labour Coalition, which is often labelled somewhat as the tough law and order administration during that period, the label is usually applied in the negative sense or as a form of criticism of that administration, I think it's fair to say, but they did face substantial issues in the mid-1970s, significant increase in violence in the south. And they were informed, the cabinet was informed, late 73 they were informed first, actually, that that information had come through on Garda Síochána that there was an element of a subversive group who were intending to target the family members of the cabinet ministers, right, with a view to kidnapping those members, yeah.
And ultimately, we don't know much about that or how it was planned or how it was played out, but it was a threat that sufficiently concerned them that there was extra security provided, was it?
Absolutely. So again, thankfully, nothing ever came to pass. The Gardaí the cabinet were advised to advise their children in particular to be careful of strangers that might approach them in any context. Extra security was provided again to specific ministers, but not necessarily to all of the ministers in that particular context. There was an agreement at cabinet at the time. I mean, it's somewhat, when we think about it now, it's a rather morbid thing to have to consider. But there was an agreement at cabinet at that time that in the event of a successful, if you will, kidnapping, or in other words, if a child was, or any family member was kidnapped, that the cabinet minister who was affected in question, he would, and they were all men at this stage, he would recuse himself from any discussion on the matter, possibly even recuse himself from cabinet in its entirety during the event, and that there would be no concessions under any circumstances given to the kidnappers, no matter what the nature of the threat, which obviously then would have the potential very negative impact that could result in the fatality of the person who was kidnapped. So this was
right. They didn't want the complicating emotion of love being introduced into any discussion,
correct,
and allow that maybe somebody to advocate for the payment of a ransom,
yes,
or for a concession to be made, or people to be released from,
correct,
prison, or the conditions of prisoners to be amended in response to a kidnapping threat, or
exactly,
whatever the leverage was. I mean, we are talking about this jurisdiction. It should be said there were attempts on and murders of politicians north of the border,
yes,
as well. And I mean, we do have a situation where on this side of the border too, there was Eddie Fullerton in 1991 was mm-hmm. murdered by loyalist paramilitaries in Donegal. Mm-hmm. We did also have the murder of a Fine Gael politician, a senator, which was a shock to the country. It hadn't been seen, the like hadn't been seen in 50 years.
Correct, that's entirely correct. So, and it wasn't just ministers who came under threat for, you could argue, the explainable, not understandable or acceptable, but the explainable reason that they were involved in the legislative process or implementing tough or robust measures against paramilitaries, but also ordinary members, if you will, or backbenchers in some of the political parties. And that example that you're... tragic example that you're after highlighting there, or implying there, Colm, is in relation to Senator Billy Fox, a member of the Fine Gael Party, had been a TD between 1969 and 1973, lost his seat, in the 73 election, ironically somewhat, it seems, due to his rather pro-nationalist stance with the view with respect to what was happening in Northern Ireland. There's a belief that he lost some of the local Protestant vote, despite him being a Protestant himself, in the Monaghan area as a consequence of his stance on the North, his pro-nationalist view of stance. But ultimately, in early 1974, March 1974, there was an attack on the home of his, not his home, or again to indicate the extent to which family members can be impacted here, and relatives, but on the family home of his fiancée. So his fiancée's family home was attacked in Monaghan in March 1974 in what was clearly and demonstrably a blatant sectarian attack on that home.
Not aimed at him, but aimed at Protestant landowners.
Correct. Well, it wasn't even that there were landowners. The claim was on the part, it seems anyway, that the claim on the part of the paramilitaries was that they believed that the house might hold weapons that were linked to the UVF. Now, there's absolutely no evidence for that. This is possibly something they claimed afterwards as a means of attempting to obviate some of their guilt or alleviate some of their guilt. But in any event, it was a demonstrably sectarian attack on the home of the fiancé of Billy Fox. He happened to arrive on the scene as the attack was taking place, with the ultimate consequence that he was then chased down by members of the Provisional IRA that were involved in that particular action, and he was murdered on that night. So the attack might not have been intended originally to target him. It was intended to target people who happened to be in his personal ambit, if you will, but it ultimately resulted in him being murdered, and it had a significant impact, I think it's fair to say, on the body politic as well as on society down here. Because as you alluded to, Colm, he was the first politician killed in such a fashion, essentially, since Kevin O'Higgins in 1927.
The political response to this, so, you know, if threats tip over into actual violence, the state's response to this also constrains the civil liberties of everybody. I mean, if you want to go back to, you know, the Civil War era that you were talking about there, you know, a politician called O'Diver was shot in his grocery store, but the person was never brought to justice. But one of the people suspected of it was taken out and murdered near Newlands Cross in a sort of deniable extrajudicial killing by the state.
Him and
a lot of other people, because it was outside the city limits. People were killed out there so that it wouldn't get, I think it wouldn't be investigated by the DMP. Was that the rationale for that?
That was probably part of the rationale. The other was just to give it maybe more time before the matter was discovered, etc. But yes, it would have been outside the DMP's jurisdiction in most cases, I think.
Right. Yeah. And some evidence that the inquest, I think, into that particular shooting of the individual concerned, Bobby Bonfield, may have been interfered with by the state in terms of what it could find about that. So everybody's liberties are affected by this, because if the state is, I suppose, shocked into acting repressively in response to political violence, everybody loses out. It ends up having a knock-on effect. It shouldn't be taken lightly.
Absolutely not. It does have a knock-on effect. Once the situation occurs in which democratically elected politicians in any democracy, but certainly a liberal democracy such as ours, come under threat in such a fashion, it will have a knock-on, it has to actually have a knock-on impact on the rest of our liberties to a certain extent, because we need to protect our democratic processes, and I suppose I'm speaking personally now as opposed to a historian, so apologies to your listeners, but we need to protect our democratic processes, and that means we need to protect our politicians, and if that means having to unfortunately curb the behaviour of certain people from time to time in order to protect our democracy, then that is an unfortunate and disagreeable sometimes necessity from time to time. But of course, it's vitally important that that be tempered by a judiciary and a political system that's able to balance that in the correct fashion, so that civil liberties are not so badly impinged upon that the rights of individuals to enjoy their own personal and peaceful lives is affected.
Right.
So it's a very delicate balance, Colm.
No room for complacency, though, Shane. I mean, you know, we began in the 1920s, it crops up again in the 1970s, and here we are 50 years later. So anyway, certainly, food for thought and for vigilance. We're going to take a quick break. We're back in a minute. Nicola Pearce, good afternoon to you.
Hiya, Colin. How are you?
Good. How are you keeping today?
Well, I'm 8 months and 1 week into my widowhood. So it just goes up and down. I lost my husband, my lovely husband, Niall, on the 3rd of January, about 2 o'clock. It was a Friday. It was absolutely freezing cold outside. And I've basically spent the last 8 months learning to live without him.
All right. And I'm very sorry to hear about that. I'm sure it doesn't seem much easier today than the day you heard it. But tell us about Niall.
Niall was from Trim. He was an accountant. He was my rock. When I panicked, he stayed calm. He would tell me when I was overthinking. I relied on him for everything. He paid all the bills. I'm a full-time writer. He allowed me just to write. I didn't even have to open up letters from the tax office. He would just look after all of that. And he made me laugh, and he was my big companion. If I wanted to go dancing on a Saturday night or go and listen to classical music, he was there right beside me. Whatever I wanted to do, he did it.
Right. Was he much of a dancer?
We had one. He wasn't, no, but he let me dance.
Love is.
Which was all I wanted to do.
So
absolutely.
You met him back in the 1990s, by almost
That's right.
by accident.
Sort of. My first marriage had come to an end and I needed a place to live and I couldn't afford a house by myself. So a girl I worked with in Iceland supermarket in Tala was moving out and told me to ring her flatmate, who was a guy. And I remember standing on the shop floor in Tala and making that phone call. And as soon as he answered, I felt I knew him. Just absolutely felt this massive movement within me, and went and met him, and I pretty much fell head over heel within a few days of moving in. And it was just that I remember we went out for a drink one night. We haven't got together yet, but we listened to a musician, a trad musician, and you got chatting to the actor, and he was like, "Oh, Nicola and Niall, Niall and Nicola. Of course these are meant to be together." And that probably played a huge part in both of us realising that we were wonderful for one another. Right. And we did break up for 10 years. But then we got back almost 10 years to the day. So I look back now, I'm 56, I look back at my life and Niall has played a huge part in it, and falling in love with him again has played a huge part of it, because I fell in love after we got back together again. And then when he was, we got this terrible diagnosis last November, terminal, he was too ill for treatment. And then I watched him come into his own, his courage, his bravery. He had no fear of dying. He believed in the afterlife, probably because I did talk about that sort of stuff a lot. He was looking to meet his mother and father again.
He lost them both in quick succession, just shortly before he died.
Yes, his dad died in 2022. His mother, I mean, this is why I'm still in disbelief. This time last year, his mother was still alive. She was 92 and anxious to join her husband. So we'd only just got over her death. She's a year gone this weekend. And then within weeks of her going, I mean, the shock, Niall and I planned a big holiday this year. We were going to go to Canada. And then suddenly we were dealing with just the ridiculous news that he was going to die. They gave him 5 months and he managed 7 weeks. We neither of us believed in 5 months.
All right. And it did come as a shock. I mean, he had supported you all along. I mean, you'd had your own health issues as well. And then Niall, was it stomach and back that first kind of manifested itself, and he went in to have it checked out?
That's right. He was complaining about, this time last year again, a bad stomach, but he was caught up in going back and forth to his mother in Trim. So he had been given tablets, but he put off taking them. So he was constipated and then he had diarrhea. And then this really, really bad back pain kicked off in early November. And we got a letter made out and I brought him down to A&E in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital here in Drogheda. And once they heard he filled in on his previous couple of weeks, they rushed him straight through. Again, I didn't think of the word cancer. He didn't say it to me. Turned out he was thinking of that. But once cancer was mentioned, well, okay, we'd both gone through this as a couple in 2018. I'd stage 3 breast cancer, and 2018 was lost in chemo, radiation, a couple of operations. So once you have a problem, you're looking for the solution. So when he was given this, all he was told was that his insides were a complicated mess. So we just waited to hear from the oncologist. We knew now it was cancer, but we knew, we believed, we assumed there would be a path of treatment. So that's what we had to wait for. By which stage he was getting worse, the pain was getting worse, and they were really struggling to control the pain. And then the oncologist comes in, and gosh, he looked 20 years younger than me, and sat down and very, very gently broke it to us that there would be no treatment, that now was too far gone.
Could you, I'm sure you could hardly believe it.
In a way, I remember the oncologist looking a bit shocked, because I think we both looked relieved. What was worse was waiting for the oncologist to come in. That took about 5 or 6 days. Both of us separately by this stage suspected the worst. And then to have him confirm that, certainly Niall, I think he may even have smiled. The oncologist just thought, what was going on in this room? But if you don't know what it's like to wait for what might be the worst news you're ever going to hear, but you're not really sure. I mean, palliative care, they told me I must have started grieving immediately. And even though you're preparing yourself and you know he's going to die, there's just no way. I mean, I've got a great imagination. I'm a writer. I could not imagine him dying, me doing a funeral, and then me coming back to live in the house without him. That just, it just didn't make sense. And I kind of had to put that at the back of my head. And we did have these wonderful talks. So in the end, we'd seven precious weeks together. And I feel very, that was a luxury, because I've met women whose husbands died in a tragic accident or died very suddenly with no preparation, no word of warning. So I had these precious 7 exhausting weeks where I think, it sounds really selfish, but I think my biggest feeling was guilt. I just felt guilty all the time.
Why?
Palliative care. I was guilty because it was exhausting, and I felt guilty and shame over the fact that sometimes I was just thinking about how tired I was, and I would be looking at my watch, and I'd been in the hospital for the previous 8 hours, and now I was hungry and I wanted to come home and make my dinner, and I'd have tremendous guilt. But he allowed me. Every night I got into this little routine. Have you got everything beside you? Have you got the urine bottle beside you? Have you got the bell for the nurses beside you? And I'd sit there. I'd leave him with everything, his Kindle, and he'd listen to music. And then he'd smile and let me go like off home. And I'd run home and I'd be glad to be home and then get up and see him the next morning. So I couldn't make sense of my feelings sometimes. But, you know, I went in every single day for 7 weeks, spent all day in there. And I tried to stay over one night. I assumed that's what I would be doing in the last couple of weeks. But actually, the nursing staff prefer a family don't, because you are just in the way. I thought I was doing a brilliant thing. And that one night, I settled down. I couldn't sleep, because I can never sleep. But worse than that, Niall needed pain, and he needed to move and adjust his position in bed, and he felt he couldn't in case he disturbed me.
Right.
So he ended up getting really upset, and I think I ran. It was been 5:30 in a winter's morning. I ran home to the house absolutely mortified, because the nurse had agreed, yeah, you shouldn't be here. It's just, you're in the way, without meaning to, but just everything had gotten so heightened by that stage.
It sounds almost that your life was so hectic, you barely had a moment to really engage in the kind of thinking ahead and grieving at that point and preparing for the grief.
Yeah, there's no preparation for the grief. I mean, they told me I must have started grieving. All I know is that I had to bring him in a brochure and we flicked through it looking at coffins. And then I came in one day. He was absolutely thrilled with himself. He an ad for a black shirt and a black tie popped up on his Facebook page. He'd ordered it. And I was to photograph it against his red velvet wedding jacket, which is what I did when it arrived and brought it into him. So it became very surreal. He was a man that wasn't really, most of the time, wasn't into dressing up, but he became quite nearly obsessed about how he was going to look in the coffin. And I just kind of, you just go along with it. He was sending me out on errands. I have to go and buy a belt that didn't have a book. I didn't even really understand what I was looking for. But thankfully, a lovely man here in Drogheda, one of the men's shops, was able to look after me. So Niall would never have put me out, ever. He's the most easygoing guy. But with the drugs and the pain, and then he did start to a little bit worried. The only time he ever broke down was Christmas Eve, and he broke down because he needed somebody to wipe his backside when he went to the loo. He, you know, I mean, I'm looking at my 56-year-old husband, who was always strong and solid and able to do anything, my hero. And he was sobbing on Christmas Eve and then spent the next 2 hours apologising to me because he cried. This is the sort of man he was. This is the sort of man that I've lost.
And you did, as you say, you had to let him go on January 3rd this year. Can you stay with us for a moment? Because we're going to just take a quick short break and we'll be back after this. Nicola Pearce, good afternoon to you. You're back.
Good afternoon, Colin.
I'm sorry for interrupting there. There was breaking news of escalation of war in the Middle East. But where we left off before we took the break, before we came to you, was ultimately on January 3rd of this year, you lost your husband, Niall. You were saying in advance you didn't really have the chance to grieve in advance of that. Is that when it hit?
You're just caught up in everything. And it's exhausting, and you're trying to be strong for him, and you can do nothing else around this time. Your husband is dying. You're not doing anything else. Your whole world is about this. But like I would have thought, it mentally it's hard, because if you go through a tough situation, you normally have an reward at the end of it. I was having to do the very best that I could for him. Try not to think about myself, but also I was just thinking, there's no reward here. This ends with his funeral and a life without him. And that really played an awful lot of problem in my head, trying to keep motivated. But the nurse of palliative care were just brilliant. They would take me off for mini counselling sessions. Now I would just think I'd gone out to get a cup of coffee and I'd be sitting two rooms down. They would let me cry and were telling me that I was doing everything right. They'd urge me to bring her home into his hospital room. So I would actually say this to anybody going through the same thing with a terminal diagnosis. I covered the hospital wall with photographs of us on holidays, wedding photographs. I put up fairy lights. Now, Niall would say he wasn't scared of death, but he would wake up a couple of times in the middle of the night. And he said those fairy lights were a comfort. They stayed on all night. The photographs were brilliant. If you had visitors coming in, they were a bit nervous. They weren't sure what Niall was going to look like. You could point to a photograph and have a conversation. So I found that enormous help. And all those photographs, I brought them home and put them up on the wall of our bedroom and front room. And I continue to talk to them to this day.
And did you get to say goodbye to him in the end before he died?
No, not really. It's all a bit clouded in my head. There was days I was going in, he'd stop sort of looking at me. Then there was other days when he seemed alert for about 15 minutes and that he was just sleeping. I'd been told to expect this. He's going to start sleeping a lot more. Now, I had told Niall that because I didn't believe in keeping information for him. So I think for a while there, he was trying to stop himself from sleeping, which was just impossible. So I had a last night, which I didn't realise was the last night. All I knew was, like, I definitely have to be here. He didn't know I'd come back into the room. I just stayed there. And in the middle of the night, the nurse explained to me that she'd rang the head of palliative care. And what did I want to do? Just make him comfortable. And I'm standing in the corridor looking at her going, do you mean this is it? So he was still conscious. I was able to ring his family the next morning. They came from Trim. And I whispered in his ear, Niall, I'm just stepping outside. I've got to go home and sleep. I haven't slept in 3 nights, but your brothers and your sisters are here. If you need to go, don't wait for me. I didn't need to be there for the last breath. Stepped out of the room, and my two sisters, Lynn and Rachel and Gail, were coming to collect me. And then Niall's brother, Jerry, rang. Nicola, he's gone. It was no big, there was no big moment. He'd just stopped breathing. So I was only down the corridor. So he waited for me to step out of the room. I feel he waited for them to be around him. Either way, he looked after us all. He went at the most perfect time. And then my two sisters were on their way. They were just minutes away. So, yeah.
And when the funeral is over and, you know, the house is quiet, who's the first person you reach to outside of the family?
Well, the Gary Kelly Cancer Support Centre was a place that were very helpful for me when I went through cancer in 2018. I had just joined the choir. It was the last social night that Niall and I had done. We'd launched a book with the Gary Kelly Cancer Support Centre and the choir had sung and Niall had come along. He was in pain. But he came along and when he was dying in hospital, he made my sisters, my family, anyone that came in, make sure she goes back to that choir. If he hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have gone back. I remember the week after the funeral, I just wanted to die. I remember standing here in the kitchen, put on the kettle, and I thought, no, I don't want to be here. But palliative care, they'd warned me that these feelings would come in. They came, they went. I didn't want to go to the choir. I just stood there in the kitchen talking to a photograph. I have to go tonight. I don't want to go. Okay, I'll just go for tonight, and that's it. Made me promise I'll go for tonight. I went that night, fell in love with the choir, and that has proved a massive, massive help and support, along with friends taking me out for lunches and walks. You just say yes to everything, you know.
Really?
The other thing is I can't write.
Even when you feel like not saying yes at all.
I think there's been one day in the 8 months when I just contacted the family and just said, sorry, I can't come, can't do it. And I just sat home and cried. Most of the time, yeah, I get myself out the door, especially when we're going for a walk in the fresh air. And I'm surrounded by people who let me talk about it. Now, that is so important. If that's, you know, people might think, I don't know what to say. Oh, I won't go near because I don't know what to say. Just let me talk about Niall. That's a present enough for me, because I still love talking about him and I hate to feel that he's been forgotten. And I probably do still talk about him quite a lot, even up to now, but it's only been 8 months and I have to keep reminding myself that too. There is a wonderful resource on Facebook. The Widowed in Ireland Facebook page has been absolutely brilliant. This is for men, women, any age, people with families, no families, who have lost a loved one, a spouse, a live-in partner.
But you can just go on and post, I'm having a tough time.
Yeah, that's it. In the middle of the night. No, we've seen people put up, right, I've gone out, there was the family lunch, now I'm home again, I'm crying my eyes out. I managed to bring a face myself with the grandchildren, but I'm sitting here crying my eyes out. He's gone 5 years and here I am sitting here. And all people are just sharing all of that stuff because they know it's a safe space and they'll have 20 people going, completely understand where you're coming from. It's a really, really great resource. And there's also meetups within that group throughout the different counties. So for anyone who's widowed, I really would recommend getting onto that page. You'll have to prove that you were widowed. But, you know, even for administration questions, questions about solicitors' rights and the pension scheme, there's somebody there who can answer a question that you've got. And we've all been through it. I can't even put a price on that comfort of being in a conversation with people who know exactly what you're going through.
Yeah, there must be immense trust just to know that it's not somebody saying, you know, I know how you feel, or I can't imagine how you feel. These are people who just know it viscerally.
Absolutely.
I'm conscious that, you know, you are a writer. Your book, Great Irish Wives, Remarkable Lives from History, is out at the moment, or it's to be launched in Drogheda on Thursday. But that requires you sit on your own in a room and write this. I mean, how is it to sit on your own and focus on writing when you're going through such appalling grief?
Well, I have to say, I'm glad this book has been launched this week because I haven't been able to write. I normally write children's novels. I've an idea there. I've most of the research done and I can't seem to get myself to sit down and write. And I went to grief counselling and she explained to me that grief has taken up all the space in your head. There's no room for creativity because, of course, as a woman, as a writer, if I'm not working, suddenly I'm feeling guilty. It's another thing to whip myself over the head with. I'm not producing, I'm not being productive, I'm not working, but I just can't. I've given myself the summer off. Normally I'm a very busy writer. Normally I do loads and loads of school events and festival events. But I just don't have it in with me at the moment. I'm doing the Dublin History, actually, festival event about great Irish wives, and that might just be it. And there's a part of me dreading that, and I haven't even sat down to start making that PowerPoint presentation because my concentration has just gone to shot. And I just have to trust it'll come back and I will be writing again, because enough to have lost my partner, my best friend, my supporter, but to lose that thing, that is how I make my money and gives me an escape from worries. To have lost that is really terrifying for a writer.
Well, Nicola, we wish you all the best with the book and all, you know, I wish you all the comfort in the world as you come through this grief. And thanks very much for joining us today. And apologies for interrupting to go to that breaking news, but it's been great talking to you. I'm sure it's been a help to listeners out there who are in a similar situation to hear somebody talking about where they may be at the moment or who are contemplating that in the near future. Nicola Pearce, thanks very much for that.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
Now, we had meant to come to Nicola Pierce after the break. Obviously, we wouldn't take a decision lightly not to come back to her, but there is breaking news of an escalation of war in the Middle East. And the Israeli Defence Force has said it has conducted strikes on Qatar, targeting the leadership of Hamas, who have a presence in Qatar. That's where many of their negotiating team and senior members have lived over the years. Qatar hosts a number of political delegations from varying factions in the Middle East. The Taliban had offices there as well. The Israeli Defence Forces have made the decision to attack Qatar in order to target the Hamas leadership there. Anthony Carney, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
You're a nurse in Doha.
Yeah, nurse practitioner in a pediatric emergency there in the Women and Children's Hospital in Doha City.
What's going on there at the moment?
Well, it's just all after what's happened there in the last 30 minutes. We just heard some explosions, kind of similar to what we heard the last time. But we weren't expecting that. There's been no warnings or anything like that. So I just thought, I was outside the car on the phone and I could hear them. And I thought, what the hell is this? Maybe 8-10 explosions, sounding very similar to the ones we heard before. So then there's a shooting range in the area. We thought maybe just some explosions. And then the WhatsApp group started kicking off. There was talk of a gas station explosion. But it was 10 multiple explosions, so it didn't really sound like something like that. And then we heard that there was a planned attack, an Israel strike, on the actually just down beside where we live in the embassy area. So we were away from the embassy. So then, I suppose I have as much information as you regarding a strike and Hamas leaders living in the area, and the Israeli have claimed responsibilities. So,
and what are you seeing, Anthony? Are you in a position where we're seeing pictures on some of the television screens here of smoke rising over some areas of Doha?
Yeah.
Are you seeing that?
Not from where I am, because I'm away from the West Bay, the city area. But those pictures you're seeing with that white arch bridge, that's just down beside West Bay. That's kind of where we live, where the explosion, the smoke is rising from, is the embassy area.
And is there concern in Doha, Anthony? I mean, do you know of what the protocols are if there is an attack? Is it something that you've ever even thought would affect Doha?
Well, I thought maybe after the last time there might be something and measures in place. But, like, I'm just standing in the mall here now. I don't know if everyone's heard it. I don't know if everyone knows what's going on. But it's just people are walking around oblivious to it all.
And are there television screens in the mall? Is there showing Al Jazeera or any pictures there?
No, nothing. No live TVs in the mall. Yeah, so we just stayed here because we didn't want to go back home. We live over beside where that was, so we let that pass.
All right. The Al Jazeera, of course, which is based in Doha. It's the Qatari station.
Not far from Norfolk, Jordan.
They're quoting Hamas sources. They're saying the Israeli attack targeted Hamas ceasefire negotiators, and the Israeli media is reporting, quoting senior Israeli officials, that the attack was aimed at top Hamas leaders, including Khalil al-Haya, the chief in Gaza. And as you say, there's smoke seen rising over the Qatara district in the capital, according to one eyewitness there. That's an area you'd be familiar with, is it?
Yeah, it's not really. It's a little bit away from Qatara. That was the first kind of messages came out that it was around that area, but it's more over towards the embassy area. Just from the pictures I'm looking at, because the pictures all start to roll in and the videos in our WhatsApp group there. I don't know. I suppose we've heard rumors that there are living there. We don't know if there's anything.
Right. You'd be taking stock yourself, no doubt, of your own situation. I mean, would you have concerns for your own safety, for the safety of colleagues?
Well, absolutely. I suppose the kids, since the last time, if the door bangs now, the little one is concerned. She's saying, what's that noise? So, but we were kind of reassured after the last event that it seems to be a little bit more planned than expected. And now, we did see some messages that had gone out to the Al-Adeid Army Base people. That's been sent on to our groups now, that there was a red alert for an imminent strike.
Yeah, the Israeli officials that have been quoted in the media say that the US was notified before these strikes hit Qatar. So,
yeah. But anyway, it didn't filter down.
Right. So, I mean, do you know, you'll have to obviously have a think about this. Does it affect your future plans, or will you see how it pans out over the next few days and weeks first?
Yeah, well, I think it does have a major bearing on them, all right. We thought that, you know, that was just an isolated incident the last time, controlled incident. We had no fears or worries. And we have to, I mean, settle back down to life here. Everything was okay. But today now is just taken so by surprise. It's a bit of a shock, to be honest. So, like, if this is something that's going to be continuing or tit for tat or any kind of retaliation, then it's definitely not somewhere we want to be.
Right. The Qataris, authorities, as you'd expect, have condemned the attack as cowardly, saying it's a flagrant violation of international law. You were only half wrong when you were thinking that it was entirely due to, you know, something like a petrol station, because there's a Lectifa petrol station has been hit, and that is contributing to some of the plumes of black smoke. Apparently, it's right next door. It's a small residential compound guarded by the Qataris. Amiri guard 24 hours a day since the beginning of the Gaza conflict. That the petrol station there was struck beside that, so that is contributing to some of the smoke, according to what we're seeing reported here.
It makes sense. But look, everyone scrambles at the beginning. The information is not always accurate, but it seems to be coming more clear now. Intentional strike.
Okay, well, mind yourself, Anthony. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
All right. The U.S. Thank you. The U.S. Embassy in Qatar is saying they've seen reports of missile strikes occurring in Doha. The U.S. Embassy has instituted a shelter-in-place order for their facilities, and U.S. citizens are advised to shelter-in-place and monitor their feed there. The Qatari reaction in full says the state of Qatar strongly condemns the cowardly Israeli attack that targeted residential buildings housing several members of the political bureau of Hamas in the Qatari capital Doha. That's a quote from the Qatari foreign minister spokesman Majed Al Ansari. He posted that on X. If we get any further breaking developments, we'll obviously bring them through to you before now and the end of the programme. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute.